May it please the court, my name is Joe Yackel. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Robert Brooks. Mr. Brooks was convicted of second-degree murder and armed criminal action arising out of the death of his fiancée, Amanda Cates. His defense trial was that he acted in self-defense. He testified his fiancée pointed a gun at him, and the gun went off in the struggle that ensued while he was trying to disarm her. The evidence he presented, if the jury believed his credibility, would have resulted in his acquittal. Throughout the trial, the prosecution endeavored to undermine his credibility by highlighting the fact that after he had been Mirandized, he never explained to the detectives who were interviewing him how the shooting occurred. The implication was clear. If Mr. Brooks had acted in self-defense as he had claimed, he would have said so while being questioned by the police. By emphasizing his failure to tell the police that he had acted in self-defense after he had been Mirandized, the prosecution violated his right to remain silent and impermissibly undermined his credibility with the jury, thereby denying him a fair trial. In Doyle v. Ohio, the United States Supreme Court held it is fundamentally unfair and a deprivation of due process to allow the prosecution to impeach the defendant by commenting on post-Miranda silence. This is due to the implicit assurances that there will be no penalty for exercising the right to remain silent. Thus, every post-Miranda silence is insolubly ambiguous. The focus is on impeachment. State can impeach a defendant with post-Miranda silence if he makes if his post-Miranda statements are inconsistent with his trial defense. The Supreme Court has never found there's a waiver of the right to remain silent. The issue has always been, has the defendant made a post-Miranda statement that was inconsistent with a statement he made at trial?
Were any of the statements that he made post-Miranda inconsistent with his position at trial as self-defense?
This, I don't think so, Your Honor. The issues that have been raised by the state are that he said, Mr. Brooks said, it wasn't in response to a question. He said that I have nothing to hide. I think this was all in the context of whether he's free to go or not. He asked, "Can I leave or am I under arrest?" And in the context of that exchange, he said, "I don't have anything to hide. I didn't do nothing at all."
But if they were inconsistent, I thought from your brief, she said you agree it can be cross-examined about inconsistencies, but you disagree about whether he can be cross-examined about his silence or whether he waived that right by speaking at all.
Right. I don't think the statement that I didn't do anything is inconsistent with self-defense. It's self-defense. It's not guilty by reason of self-defense. I think those statements aren't inconsistent. And if they are, I mean, I can only imagine that most defendants that are Mirandized will make similar statements. I mean, that is not far afield to say that I didn't do anything.
Do they have to be more specific?
I think there needs to be more. I think there has to be some sort of more of a story that is a complete statement of the involvement in the crime or the non-involvement of the crime, such as I wasn't there, I have an alibi, and then the alibi turns out to be not the defense, the different defense raised at trial. I don't think what Mr. Brooks said went anywhere near far enough to constitute an inconsistency with his defense of self-defense. The state also points out this transcript of his recorded interviews, he says, "I don't know," a few times. In the reply brief, I point out that if you listen to the video recording, he doesn't ever say, "I don't know," in response to a question asking him, "What happened? Tell us your side of the story." He never says, "I don't know what happened." It's just a bad transcription. If you listen to the video, it's not what he says. But assuming that he made a statement that was inconsistent, what could the state do with that? They could impeach him with it, but they didn't impeach him. They never asked him what he said to the detectives. The theme of the prosecution's case was he never said anything. You know, he did he ever tell you what happened? He never told us what happened. Not a word. He never said anything. On cross-examination of Mr. Brooks, they said, "Did you ever tell him what happened?" "No, I never said a word." That was the theme of the case. He never said anything. He never offered an explanation. So So the position of the state trial was he never said anything, and that's what the prosecutor argued to the jury. And now I think it's fundamentally unfair to turn around now for the first time in the appellate process and say, wait a minute, he did say something. He said these things, then now he's waived his right to remain silent.
That argument was not made below? Selective silence?
No.
That he waived it?
No. The prosecutor just went with, he never said a word, and asking the various police officers and Mr. Brooks and in closing argument that he never said a word. That was the theme of the case. He was silent. He didn't offer an explanation as to what happened. And now we get to the appeal when we say, wait a minute, he didn't, you know, you
so,
made,
so what is enough to waive your right to remain silent?
Well, as you can tell by the cases that both the Mr. McBrang and I have cited, it's tough to draw a line. There's no question it's tough to draw a line. And I think there has to be something more of a complete statement as to what something beyond something could be construed as just a denial of guilt. I didn't do anything can mean I'm not legally culpable. It doesn't mean I wasn't there. Everybody knew he was there. He called the police. He was there at the scene when the paramedics and the police initially responded.
It appears that on this record, based upon the objections raised, that it's inappropriate comment on his right to remain silent, that sometimes the trial court sustained the objection and actually gave a curative instruction, and then sometimes the trial court didn't sustain the objection. Is that?
I would agree with that, and some of the curative instructions were the initial reference in the opening statement when they asked him what happened, not a word, never said anything, never told him anything. And then he comments on, we have to turn the tape off because he invokes his rights, so I'm going to turn the tape off. And there's an objection, and the objection is to the referencing the right to remain silent. And the judge, though, actually, is very specific. He ruled the prosecutor's statement that Mr. Brooks said not a word was clearly a direct comment on his right to remain silent and cautioned the prosecutor not to refer to it further. The next thing the prosecutor said was, he was repeatedly asked what happened. He never told him anything. And I think
you're saying the comments were repeated so much and the references that they instruction was insufficient to cure it.
I think, as this court in Dexter and other cases by the Court of Appeals has held that in some instances it's enough to have one statement or a few statements or references to post Miranda silence is enough to constitute reversible error. And in the case of State versus Rogers, the Court of Appeals, actually, there was the first reference to a post-Miranda silence was preserved, as I think this one was in this case. And then there are two other incidents that weren't preserved, one of which there was no objection made at all, and the other one just the general objection that wasn't based on the constitutional right to remain silent. And the Court of Appeals said, well, we're going to look at the other two unpreserved issues or unpreserved references in analyzing whether the prosecution exploited the post-Miranda silence. But I guess what I'd like to point out is, the case of State versus Graves is similar to this case. There, the prosecution pointed out an opening statement and its case in chief made numerous references to pre-Miranda silence, post-arrest pre-Miranda silence, and while that's proper to use for impeachment purposes, the Court of Appeals says there was no impeachment possible. There was nothing to impeach. The defendant had not put on any evidence. It was improper to impeach at that point. And that's consistent with what the United States Supreme Court has said. Every Supreme Court case is talking about impeachment. Anderson versus Charles is instructive in that regard. And I think that it really controls this case. In that case, the prosecution on cross-examination was attempting to impeach the defendant, who at one point initially told the police officer he got the car 2 miles away from where the bus station was, and then at trial he testified he got it from a lot right next to the bus station. Clearly inconsistent statements. And the prosecutor started asking, don't you think it's rather odd that if that were the truth, that you stole the car from the lot next to the bus station as you're testifying to a trial, that you didn't come forward with it and tell anybody at the time you're arrested where you got that car? And then later on, but maybe a dozen questions later, the prosecutor says, well, you told the detective back when you were first arrested you stole the car back on two street names that were 2 miles away from that bus station. And the Sixth Circuit held that the first question was improper and the second question was proper because it drew out the inconsistency between the two statements. And the Supreme Court said, well, you know, if you take it as a whole, it's clear that he's referencing the inconsistency, the prosecutor's referencing the inconsistencies. Here, there was never anybody, no question was asked to Mr. Brooks, what did you tell the detectives? They never said to Mr. Brooks, ever cross-examined Mr. Brooks saying, did you tell the police officers anything? No, I never said anything. Mr. Brooks, didn't you tell them you didn't do anything at all? That's proper impeachment. What they did was they talked about things he never said. You never told them. These are questions that were never asked to Mr. Brooks, that they asked the detectives or other police or the detectives. Did he ever say the shooting was an accident? Did he ever tell you they had been fighting for 45 minutes? Did he ever tell you he told her to quit? Did he ever say he told her not to get up? Did he ever say where he got the gun from? Did he ever say Amanda did anything to cause him to shoot her? This putting words in his mouth. He was never asked those questions. He never said those things. He never denied it. He never said anything. Ultimately, he evoked his right to remain silent. And that's what distinguishes this case from Antwine, from Hutchinson, from Smart, and from a number of other cases. I don't think there's a single case that the state has cited that involves an invocation of Miranda at the end of an interview. Here, Mr. Brooks invoked his right to remain silent at the end of his interview and terminated the interview. And so how do we know what his answer to those questions would be? We don't know because he invoked his right to remain silent. I think it's improper the circumstances that when they don't impeach him with any of this, they never say this is what you said to the detectives and isn't that inconsistent with what you're saying now. That's impeachment, and that's what the Supreme Court of the United States has said all to be the standard, and it wasn't followed here. I see my time is up.
May it please the court. The question in this case involves a lot of different kinds of evidence. The defendant identifies each one of these different types of evidence as an improper comment on the defendant's silence post-Miranda. But in fact, that's not what this case really involves. In particular, with regard to what the prosecutor said in opening statement and with regard to the questions that were asked of the officer who questioned the defendant when he was interviewed at the police station, that testimony is about the statement that he actually gave. And the fact that there were omissions in that statement does not mean that those omissions should be equated to protected
What were the
silence.
Inconsistencies that you're saying they questioned him about?
Well, one of the inconsistencies was that he said, I didn't do anything at all. But in fact, we know that he did. We know that he pulled the trigger. We know that he shot his wife.
And he said that. I mean, he called in 911 and said, I've shot my wife. So,
well,
or my,
in the 911
girlfriend.
Call, that's what he said. Yeah. But by the time he got to the police station, which is about three statements later, he doesn't say that he shot his wife. And he won't answer the question about what he told the 911 officer. Instead, rather than invoking his right to remain silent, he uses diversionary tactics to not answer the question. He doesn't remain silent. He says, can I have a drink of water?
But now, if you look at what he did do at trial, and I know you want to address the major issue, which is that most of his questions were directed to what he did not say when he was talking to the officers, pre and post Miranda both. Not what he did say, because other than saying he didn't do anything, he didn't address any of the circumstances of the crime. And he kept, and we just heard part of the recitation, they kept saying he didn't tell us this, he didn't tell us that. Why isn't that a direct comment on his remaining silent?
Because the silence at issue there is an omission from a statement that was made.
So you're saying he waived his right to remain silent, in effect?
More or less, yes. But as the United States Supreme Court said in Anderson versus Charles, we conclude that Doyle does not apply to the facts of this case. Each of two inconsistent descriptions of events may be said to involve silence insofar as it omits facts included in the other version. But Doyle does not require any such formalistic understanding of silence, and we find no reason to adopt such a view in this case. And what that means, at least from my perspective, is if somebody makes a statement and it contains omissions, Those omissions are not silence, as
contemplated by Doyle. So if you say anything, I didn't do it, then everything else is an omission, and you can ask, say all the things I didn't say?
Probably, yes.
But doesn't the statements have to be substantive?
I think the statement has to be related to the crime. I think it has to be related to the crime. And our Missouri case law has held that. Yes.
Do you have other cases where something such as I didn't do it opens up, allows the state to comment on that?
There's an older case cited in my brief, State versus Buller, where that occurred, where the defendant was advised of Miranda warnings and said that he didn't do it.
Clearly that would open up for saying, well, you said you didn't do it, but didn't you tell the 911 operator you did? Didn't you tell this person what you were heard telling your mother? That kind of impeachment with inconsistent statements. But you're saying that you don't need to show inconsistencies at that point? You can simply talk about all the things the person didn't talk about?
Well, I think that the omissions are the inconsistencies. I think when a person gives a much more detailed account at trial and includes all kinds of exculpatory details that were not included before, those omissions are inconsistent.
So is that sort of a policy decision for us to make? What's sufficient to have given partial, what's sufficient to waive your right to say, to argue that you haven't opened yourself up for that kind of examination?
I suppose it's a question of policy, a question of what's legally sufficient to open yourself up to that. And I think our Missouri cases have looked at that, for example.
And do you open up everything or anything? What would you open up saying, I didn't do anything? About your whole life, about that day, your relationship?
If you say I didn't do anything with regard to the murder, I think you open yourself up to anything you later say about the murder that's inconsistent with that, I think you open yourself
sure.
up to that. I'm not saying it opens you up to everything, but if you make a statement about that murder, and these officers, you know, repeatedly
questioned. Well, he made no other statements, did he? I mean, that's the only statement that's on, that anyone's ever heard was, I didn't do anything.
No. He made, I think, six false statements altogether before trial. The first one was when he called 911 and said he thought he shot an intruder. He said, oh, I've shot my fiance, but in fact it was an intruder. The second false statement was when he's transferred to the police during that call, and he says he shot his fiance when she woke him up, and he didn't know who it was. The third statement he makes is when the police are on the scene, he's talking to his mother on the phone, and he says, well, she got up out of bed while I was sleeping, and then boom. The fourth statement he makes is when he's talking to another friend on the phone while the police are still at the statement, and he starts talking about an argument they had for 45 minutes. And then finally comes the fifth statement to the police at the station where he says, I didn't do anything. I have nothing to hide. I don't know. I didn't do anything at all.
Oh, and was that last one was after Miranda?
Yeah, the fifth
statement. All the rest of them were before, so they wouldn't have anything to do with his right to remain silent.
I think not. And
he was impeached on those, right?
Well, and to the extent that I think that Mr. Brooks identifies many pre-Miranda statements in his brief that simply do not implicate Doyle. And the questions asked of several of the officers, I don't think they implicate Doyle at all. But my point is that he made multiple statements leading up to the fifth statement, and then he made another statement to the victim's friend afterwards where he said it was an accident. But the point is that he made multiple different statements, so I don't think that the only thing that people heard was, I didn't do it. And that brings me around to one other point, which I think is important to determining the admissibility of the statement, because part of the argument here is that the state shouldn't even have been allowed to play the tape, because the tape, simply by virtue of the fact that it didn't contain all the details and contained omissions, was a comment on his post-Miranda silence. But the tape was itself substantive evidence of this defendant's guilt, because it represented yet another false statement in a series of five or six. And so it didn't have to be relegated to mere impeachment. It was evidence of the consciousness of his guilt. What he said in that fifth false statement. There's a long string of false statements, and I think the state can put that on and point out how different that statement is from his previous statements and from what he ultimately said at trial.
But is that different, though, than using the statement to say, and he didn't explain it?
Well, I think that's, what makes it possible for the state to say that is the fact that it's inconsistent. If it weren't inconsistent, the state could point out.
But where is it inconsistent? I mean, you're saying everything is inconsistent with I didn't do it. I mean, he's argued that saying I didn't do anything is not inconsistent with self-defense. I mean, he's offered many inconsistent statements over time, but silence is not inconsistent unless you're commenting on his right to silence. That's the only thing that makes it inconsistent.
Well, it's one thing to say it's not inconsistent with self-defense. as he does in this case. But if the defendant had gone to the police station and said, I knowingly shot her, that's also not inconsistent with self-defense. I mean, does that mean that the state can't use that statement? Certainly not. I think the state could use that statement.
But our questions are not about what he said, and that's why I want, but what he didn't say and the comments on what he didn't say.
Well, and I guess the question there is, I think the defendant is taking a formalistic view of what the word silence means and is including omissions from a statement into silence. I think what silence means under Doyle is protected silence, silence that is induced by the Miranda warning, silence that comes as a result of an invocation or a decision at some point to say, that's enough, I don't want to answer that question, I'm invoking my right to remain silent.
Basically, the argument being made was that because he didn't claim self-defense at the time, and he did at trial, that's inconsistent.
I think it is.
And so you're saying his silence is inconsistent with his later giving of a defense. And
except that I don't think he was silent. If he had been silent, what he would have done was, oh, I have the right to remain silent? Very well, then, I prefer not to answer any questions. Or,
does he have to say that? Does he have to say it, or can he just say, just stay silent?
He doesn't have to say anything. If he just remained silent and didn't answer anything, then he's fine as well. The state can't use that, because that's the same thing as, that's just invoking your right to remain silent by remaining silent.
The law doesn't require you not to say anything. The law requires a line to be drawn as to how much you say, and so you're drawing the line very, very narrowly, aren't you?
Well, I think that I would draw the line pretty narrily.
What's your backup line?
Was my backup line? My backup line is that this isn't that narrow, what happened in this case.
Let me ask a question about absent comments specifically related to the post-Miranda silence, absent comments on that, was this a close case as it related?
In my estimation, it's not a close case. The defendant made multiple false statements about this crime immediately after the murder, which I've already outlined, mm-hmm. Which I think speak volumes as to his consciousness of guilt. I think that most people would ordinarily expect somebody who acted in self-defense mm-hmm. to say that right off the bat. Additionally, I think the physical evidence in this case did not support a self-defense. Now, it's true that the defendant attempted on cross-examination of the state's expert to say, well, couldn't it have possibly been this way? Yeah, but I think there were some grudging concessions on the part of the expert. But when you got right down to it, this bullet entered the victim's cheek and then traveled on a downward course and lodged in the victim's neck. There was no soot. There was no stippling. There was, and then the victim fell backwards and cracked the back of her head. And, the expert who testified said, this is wholly consistent with a shot being fired from 18 to 36 inches away at least, and traveling up from an upward position to a lower position. That does not comport very well with a claim that the defendant tried to grab the gun where the victim was holding it.
But you put that in front of the jury.
Yeah.
You put all those facts in front of the jury, and the jury makes the decision.
Yes, but I don't think there's much chance of any rational jury looking at that particular wound in the physical evidence
and saying...
Let me ask you
this question then. It seems to me on this record that the trial judge was sustaining objections, okay, giving curative instructions.
Yes.
Okay, so at least the trial judge thought that these comments were inappropriate. And giving those curative instructions, if this wasn't a close case, why did the prosecuting attorney keep banging up against the line or going over it?
Well, I don't think the prosecutor felt like he was banging up against the line. I don't think the prosecutor saw this as an issue where there was a problem, because I think the prosecutor was operating under the assumption that Anderson versus Charles allowed him to use this evidence to impeach the defendant. And I believe that was presented to the trial court.
The trial court told him not to do that, comment on the silence.
Let me address that. The objection that was made was made when the state said that the defendant invoked his rights.
But defense counsel read and his brief recites what the judge said. He said it was beyond that.
And the judge, I think, at times was overly cautious, and in fact later sustained an objection.
The prosecutor was not overly cautious.
No, I think the prosecutor didn't need to be cautious in some of these instances because there wasn't anything wrong with it. There was an instance where the prosecutor crossed the line and said he invoked his right to remain silent. There was an objection that was sustained.
Well, if this court disagrees with you and thinks that the prosecutor agreed, that the trial court found that in the circumstances he had stepped over the line and was commenting on silence at that point, can you address whether or not the instruction was an adequate remedy or whether a mistrial was required?
Well, I can only address that with regard to a couple of questions because there were only objections to a couple of questions. There were, I think, only three objections, two of which were sustained, one of which was not because the court determined that the prosecutor's question, insofar as it did not refer to post-Miranda silence, was proper. The court was pretty clear in its later discussions that I'm going to allow you to ask whether he didn't say something, you know, during that interview because he wasn't silent. The court's clear about that. But then the court made the plain look. If you ask him a question that says, for example, well, did he ever tell you this? Then the court said, I'm going to sustain that because that could arguably refer to the post-Miranda silence after he'd invoked. So I think the court knew where the line was, or at least thought it knew, according to precedent, and the prosecutor was trying to operate within that realm. But there were only two objections, one during opening statement and one later when the prosecutor said, well, did he ever tell you this? Aside from that, there were no objections whatsoever. In fact, when the tape was played, defense counsel said, no objection. And I would argue, affirmatively waived any issue as to the admission of the tape. So whether the trial court's curative efforts were sufficient, I don't know is an answer I can say, yeah, they were sufficient, because I think it depends on whether we think the trial court was properly allowing this evidence in or properly refraining from sua sponte intervening. I don't think the trial court should have been expected to sua sponte intervene in the case. The relief that was granted at the time when there were actual Doyle violations or a potential violation, I think, was sufficient. Now, I guess that leads to the question of, well, what about all of the other instances? If the court finds that the prosecutor was pressing the line, pressing the envelope, what about all those issues? Well, all those instances. Well, the defense didn't object, so we can't ascertain whether the curative.
There's some briefing in that we apply the same test, whether or not it's plain error or preserved error.
I think you apply the same factors. You examine the same factors, but I think that the burden is different. If it's preserved, I think the standard is, you know, where there's constitutional error, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence, you know, that it didn't affect the case. But where it's plain error, whether it's a constitutional error or not, I think the defendant bears the burden of demonstrating that he suffered a manifest injustice. In other words, that these errors were outcome determinative. And I don't think that they were, particularly because there was a lot of pre-Miranda silence that the state properly commented on, which is completely outside of the Doyle realm, and there was a lot of good evidence to support his guilt in this case. Finally, I'd note, since I just have a few seconds, is that this court's prior precedents also indicate that unless the person is in custody, Doyle doesn't apply. And as I pointed out in my brief, I cited several cases where this court has said it doesn't apply. And in this case, I think there was also a basis to determine that he wasn't in custody, and as much as the police told him, you're free to leave.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Got a lot of ground to cover. The Supreme Court of the United States says the right to remain silent shall not be unduly burdened. I think the prosecutor's conduct in this case more than unduly burdened Mr. Brooks' right to remain silent and to be and to receive a fair trial by an impartial jury.
Counsel, would you? I'm struggling with the two questions or the two statements. I didn't do nothing at all, I think, and I have nothing to hide.
Right.
The I didn't do nothing at all, I'm not saying anything there. But I have nothing to hide. Sounds to me like an affirmative statement.
It's odd because in the Court of Appeals, Judge Mooney viewed both those statements the opposite way. It's striking me. That just shows how it's hard to analyze this. I think I don't have nothing to hide was, I know at least one time happened. I don't know if he said it twice, but one time was, should I leave? I want to leave. You know, am I free to go? I'm under arrest. And then he decides he's going to stay because I don't have anything to hide. This is a man whose daughter was left at his house. His fiance, if you believe his version, which a jury I think is entitled to do, he suffered an immeasurable loss. It's 2:30 in the morning. His daughter is at home. He doesn't know where she's at. No one's taking care of her. Can I leave, or can I come back, or am I free to go? And if you watch the tape, It's not real clear those officers are wanting him to leave. You know, they kind of begrudgingly say, hey, you're free to go. I really don't want you to leave. You're free to go. And then he says, I don't have nothing to hide. Well, that doesn't mean I have to tell you what everything, you know, I did today. And
well, what do you think the natural meaning is, I have nothing to hide?
Well,
what's the natural understanding of those words?
To me, it's ambiguous. It's inherently ambiguous. Who knows what he means? If you watch the tape, I mean, all I could tell from the tape is he desperately wanted to make a phone call. That's what I got out of that tape. He was in bad shape. And to me, I don't have nothing to hide in conjunction with I didn't do nothing. It all sounds to me like I'm not guilty.
Well, I didn't do nothing. We know he did something. We know that.
Well,
so that has to mean I didn't do anything wrong or a general denial.
Right. I mean, I can
understand that. But the I have nothing to hide sounds like more. That sounds like an affirmative statement.
I mean, even though it's, can I have a glass of water is an affirmative statement, too. I mean, it's hard to parse this. And I mean, the real.
So your real argument is don't try and parse too hard.
Well,
I mean, take it within context. And
the Supreme Court talks about impeachment. They didn't impeach him with this stuff. They never tried to draw out the inconsistency. They focused on his silence. And, I mean, I'll just end with saying waiver principles should be construed liberally in favor of the defendant. This was never argued below. It was just asserted. The state has the burden of proving the right to remain silent. And it's a constitutional right that can't be unduly burdened. And what happened here? It's been unduly burdened. And if I could just say one thing about the tape and it's not our position the tape should be excluded entirely. It's our position that portions of the tape where they say, if you didn't tell us what happened, how can we defend you? The parts that focus on his post-Miranda silence are permissible. The extent that
why didn't you waive it by saying no objection, Your Honor?
As I briefed it, it looked like there was to me, I think that the transcript shows there might have been a misunderstanding as to whether the Doyle applies to post-Miranda silence or you have to be under arrest at first. That's why I don't think it's a strategic decision like the State versus Johnson case is distinguishable on that basis because it wasn't a strategic decision. It didn't seem like there was it seemed more of a negligence thing than a tactical decision based on the statements in the transcript regarding the objections. And it's certainly not clear. And again, I just fold it back in to the unduly burdening the constitutional right.
So does Doyle apply when you're not in custody?
Oh, I think so. Because the whole premise of Doyle is it's the government assuring someone, you don't have to talk to us. You have the right to remain silent. The government is telling Mr. Brooks, it's unusual in this case, they Mirandize him when they put him in his interview room. They Mirandize him. I think they say out of an abundance of caution. But at that point, they've told him, you don't have to say anything. They've given him the rights, and so he's got the same implicit assurance that his silence will carry no penalty. I think that's the trigger. Most cases talk about post-arrest silence because he's arrested and Mirandized simultaneously, so post-arrest would encompass post-Miranda in most cases.
Why is this not an ineffective assistance claim rather than a claim he has a right to on direct appeal?
Well, it may be an ineffective assistance of counsel claim down the road. I hope not, obviously. But if there are a number of cases where the defense attorney never says anything, and the Court of Appeals finds it's plain error, even though there was no objection ever made, it's plain error, even though the defense counsel never made an objection or made the wrong objection. So I don't think that's any different than here.
Do those cases have the circumstances where an attorney specifically said no objection to a tape that would potentially be cumulative of any plain error?
I have not found a case that's similar to this case, and I would just say that the tape isn't an essential part of the argument. I think the significant part of this case was the prosecutor over and over referring to what he did not say
to
detectives. The only way the jury ever heard that he said, I didn't do nothing, is if they were listening very closely to that tape. It never came out anywhere else in the testimony. None of these other so-called allegedly inconsistent statements that he made never came out in any testimony, whether it was improperly through this non-impeachment, through opening statement, or state's case, or cross-examination of Mr. Brooks. It never came out, never referred to.
You're saying through the tape they may have heard his silence, but that's different than someone calling attention to his silence and saying you can draw a negative inference from it, which is what the prosecutor
You're beating him with the negative inference. You're focusing on the negative inference. You're urging the jury to draw meaning from the silence, and that's exactly what Doyle says you can't do, and that's what was done here.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your arguments this morning.